Okay, tonight we are in Proverbs, the sixth chapter. We are retreating again. I jumped ahead to chapter 7 and then got to looking at what we were skipping over and felt like there's some good stuff here. And I think you'll agree tonight, some good stuff. So we're going to cover it, and we're not under any time constraint. We're not fighting the clock here, so we'll go ahead and take a look at this tonight. I want to read the entire chapter, 35 verses, rather lengthy, but it'll give you a flavor, the flavor of what's going on here. Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth. Thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth in thy want as an armed man. A naughty person, a wicked man, walketh with a froward mouth. He winketh with his eyes, he speaketh with his feet, he teacheth with his fingers. Frowardness is in his heart, he deviseth mischief continually. He soweth discord, therefore shall his calamity come suddenly. Suddenly shall he be broken without remedy. These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him: a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. My son, keep thy father's commandment, and forsake not the law of thy mother. Bind them continually upon thine heart, and tie them about thy neck. When thou goest, it shall lead thee. When thou sleepest, it shall keep thee. And when thou wakest, it shall talk with thee. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is light, and the reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep thee from the evil woman, from the flattery of the tongue of a strange woman. Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids. For by means of a whorish woman a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned? So he that goeth into his neighbor's wife, whosoever toucheth her, shall not be innocent. I think we got some more to go here. You hadn't got there yet, huh? Okay, let me back up. I was reading it off the monitor. Where are we? 30? That doesn't look... Oh, it'd help if I was in the right chapter. Okay. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul when he is hungry. But if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. He shall give all the substance of his house. But whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding. He that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. A wound and a dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. For jealousy is the rage of a man, therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom, neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts. Let us again sort of take a look here And remember that we are in the midst of this long sort of parable in praise of wisdom, started back in chapter 1. It's going to run all the way through chapter 9. We're in this section tonight that just has some general observations. Let us just sort of think back over what we have talked about. First of all, wisdom is a the best way to describe it is a grid through which you look at things. It's your paradigm. We talk about somebody having a paradigm shift. A paradigm isn't a paradigms. It's your worldview. It's the way you look at life. Wisdom is looking at life through the grid of God's Word, through the knowledge of God. Notice we also said that we like to think that wisdom, and most of the time, to be honest, when we ask God for wisdom, what we really want is the right answer. And wisdom is not so much the right answer, it's the understanding that allows you to arrive at the right answer. And for that reason, then, wisdom, by its very nature, is not instantaneous. Wisdom, then, is to be likened to a discipline, is to put yourself under the training of something. And we, do you remember the examples that we gave? Things that just don't come instantaneously? Playing the piano or any musical instrument. You don't just sit down and master it. It takes time, takes training. What else? A craft or a trade. You can hand me a saw, but that doesn't make me a carpenter. It takes time to learn how to do it. What else? Sports, to be an athlete. You don't just overnight become an athlete. You got to work at it. You got to train. You got to get in shape. And I gave the example of learning a foreign language. It just doesn't happen instantaneously. It happens as you practice, as you put yourself under it. And so that's the idea of how wisdom works. And when we ask for wisdom, then, we need to be sure what we're asking for. We're not asking for the right answers or the ability to say, okay, I've got this, and this. We are saying, basically, we are willing to put ourselves under the tutelage of God Almighty. And that's what this is. It's couched in the terms of parental advice. That started back in chapter 1, verse 7 and 8, where the first admonition is to my son. It sort of sounds like a mother speaking in chapter 1, but quickly it sort of switches to a father speaking. And then if you'll notice in this chapter, in chapter 6, our text tonight in verse 20, where we read, my son, keep thy father's commandment and forsake not the law of thy mother. It is both parents speaking to a son. And so what follows in this chapter, chapter 6, are just some general observations about wisdom, things that we need to consider. Let's take a look at them. The first section is verses 1 through 5, and it deals with the matter of being a surety for a stranger. Now, the word surety is one that we don't use a lot today. I remember at one point in my life believing that all insurance was of the devil because, well, you don't find insurance in the Bible, you know. And then I discovered that, well, no, not with by that name, but you do, you know, I'm looking for a way to condemn Barry over here selling insurance, the devil's stuff, you know. But insurance does exist in the Bible. It simply exists under another name, and that name is surety. In Genesis 43 and verse 9, my favorite example. Anybody just off the cuff? I mean, you'll get extra credit tonight, bonus points, if you can remember what Genesis 43:9 and how surety is used there. Well, you got the right person, wrong event. But that's a good example. He gave her his cloak till he could get her payment, right? He gives her something to secure the deal, something to confirm the deal. And that's the idea of surety. Genesis 43, verse 9, yeah? Yes. That's right. Remember, they made one trip without Benjamin, and Joseph asked that they bring Benjamin with them the second trip, and Jacob doesn't want to do that. He said, I've already lost one son. I don't want to lose my second favorite of Rachel. And Judah says, I will be surety for him. And sure enough, you remember that Joseph had them plant the silver cup in Benjamin's feed sack. And they dragged them back, and he's telling them he's going to put Benjamin in prison. He's going to keep Benjamin there. And Judah speaks up and says, no, I told my father I would be surety for him. So in other words, rather than sending him to prison, I will go to prison. And it is interesting that it is at that point that Joseph breaks down and confesses and reveals himself to his brother. And of course, we have the idea in the book of Hebrews, we get the idea of suretyship in that Christ is the surety of a better covenant. So the whole idea of surety is that you are warranting something, you're guaranteeing it. It is basically insurance. This is to guarantee the deal. And so the idea here is that you have become surety for, and the King James reads friend. The word really is more like neighbor and even more like the last part of verse 1, striking your hand with a stranger. So notice this is not somebody in your household. This is not even a brother or a sister. This is someone else that's sort of outside of the circle of your close friends that you have agreed to become surety for. And notice, sort of like today, the agreement begins with your words. You've spoken that I'll do that, and then you strike hands. And the language is similar to our shaking hands. We're going to shake on it. And we're going to seal the deal, so to speak. What the problem is that when you guarantee someone else's obligation, the obligation then has shifted from them to you. I mean, the whole problem with entering into some sort of contractual agreement is that then you become obligated to follow through. But if you have someone who is standing in the wings, who is guaranteeing the arrangement, the responsibility gets shifted from the person that made the deal to the person who is the surety. You see the problem here? And we know a little bit about that in our modern culture, that when I don't have the responsibility but I'm getting the benefit, then I don't have a lot of inducement to follow through on my end because it's guaranteed. If I don't do it, here's the guy who has to, who must. He's gonna, now we can just think of all kinds of scenarios, today that would fit that. Agreeing to be somewhere at a certain place or time. Agreeing to do a certain amount of work. Agreeing to pay a certain amount of money to secure a debt. All sorts of different, situations we can envision. But notice that what has happened is that once you do that, this obligation now is yours. You're the one who's having to stand behind it. And so this creates what he calls here a snare, a trap, a bondage, that you have bound yourself in this contractual arrangement. You're hooked. You're on the hook. And notice the advice is extricate yourself from this situation just as quickly as possible. In fact, oops, let me go back. He says, don't rest, don't go to your neighbor. In one of the translations, he uses the word importunity, and you remember the parable of the importune friend who goes at midnight to his neighbor's house, banging on the door, wanting bread to feed his company that showed up at midnight. Importunity means just utter shamelessness. In other words, don't let anything whatsoever hinder you from extricating yourself from this kind of arrangement. Now, let's talk about this a minute. Almost everybody I read on this section said there are exceptions. There are times that we do this, and we do it sometimes for those of our own household, someone of our family. Sometimes in the household of the saints, we do it for a believer. But I think what this has in mind is what the scripture would call being unequally yoked together. And we talk about don't be unequally yoked together with an unbeliever. Well, what does that mean? I think it's going back to the Old Testament principle that you don't yoke an ox and an ass together in the same harness. And the reason is because the ox and the ass are two different creatures with two different natures. The ox pushes, the ass pulls. To hook them together is a disaster. And so the idea of being unequally yoked together. It's interesting. Have you ever thought about it? If it's wrong to be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, is it okay to be equally yoked together with unbelievers? You couldn't be equally yoked. Well, that's a good way of looking at it. But notice, are you yoked with unbelievers? Kitty's shaking her head. Diagonally, yeah. She's cheating. Are there a sense in which almost all of us are in some sort of a legal arrangement? It may be with an employer. If you work for yourself, you're self-employed, chances are at some point you're going to be working for somebody that's not a believer. You're going to be entering into a contractual arrangement. So what are we talking about here? What is this telling us? What is the wisdom that we are to glean? Now, Charles, he winds up hooked. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even worse. You are right that the very fact that a bank wants a co-signer tells you something. Is they don't see the deal very sure till they have a surety, till they have someone who warrants it, somebody who's got deep pockets who can stand behind it. And that ought to tell you something right there, that something. Over the years, and I know there are exceptions. My dad and his brother went into business together, and I never saw a more congenial business partnership than my dad and his brother, mainly because his brother was what they call a silent partner. And you talk about somebody who stuck to that role. I know times one of my dad's managers got all upset and went to my uncle and just unloaded and told him all the bad things my dad was doing. My uncle sat there and listened to him and then didn't say a word. He was a silent partner. He let my dad run the businesses. However, I would say that's an exception, and I almost cringe when I hear of two believers even going into partnership with each other, because it has been my experience that it almost never works out. What's that? Yeah, it just hardship. I don't know what it is, but when you get money in the mix, things go sour. Well, as long as the money's pouring in, everybody's fine, you know, as long as the business is thriving. But when things go sour, and I, early in my year's life, two of my dearest friends in partnership with one another got to the point they wouldn't even talk to one another, didn't even look at one another. And it all, everything, as long as the business was thriving, everything was great, no problems. But then when the economy turned sour and the business went under, it's cutthroat, every man for himself. And sad to see. So, but anyway, you do realize that our word then, according to this, binds us. When we do enter into these kinds of relationships, we're giving up part of our freedom. We're putting ourselves on the line, and we better be very, very sure and very careful when we do that. And notice, we might ask ourselves, the proverb says that you go to this guy's house, and you don't notice, you humble yourself in verse 3. And that gives you, I think, a clue as to why did you ever do this in the first place. And it's the idea that you want to be the big man. You're going to back the thing. You're going to guarantee the loan, that kind of thing. In other words, it's your pride that got you into this problem. So the advice is to go humble yourself. Eat your humble pie. And notice, again, make sure thy friend. That's not a very good translation. Anybody got an NIV or ESV? That is the last part of verse 3. What did he say? Plead with your friend. Plead urgently. I've got a note here, importune your friend. That's where that importunity came from. In other words, just pester him to death till he lets you out of this. And keep in mind that there's a couple of different ways you can get out. The man may agree after you pester him long enough to let you off the hook, or you may pester him to follow through on his agreement so that you then are absolved from yours, that you make certain that he fulfills his obligation. So anyway, that's the first little bit of wisdom here. And this, I think of how many young people in particular quickly put themselves into debt or into some sort of a legal binding contractual arrangement that then haunts them the rest of their life, because all of a sudden they're on the hook, and if they fail, their credit's ruined, all sorts of disasters coming from that. So for a young man, this is very sound advice. Be very, very careful who you enter into a contract with, who you become surety for. So that's the first little nugget of wisdom. And these are sort of like pearls on a string here. They're not necessarily connected to one another. They're just sort of strung together. The second one is to become industrious. And the ant is given as an illustration of industry. And I don't know if you know what a fortiori argument is, but it's arguing from the strength is the Latin. And sometimes you're arguing from the greater to the lesser. For instance, you can say if a man is dead, he certainly can't walk. That's arguing from the greater to the lesser. But most of the time in Scripture, I find these a fortiori arguments from the lesser to the greater. If it's true in this case, how much more true should it be in this case? And that's exactly the kind of a fortiori argument we have right here. In other words, he says, first of all, look at the ant. Now, almost every one of us would assume that we have a little more sense than an ant. I mean, I think I do. I don't know about you, but I think I know a little more than an ant knows. You would have to say an ant, compared to a human being, is a pretty meager creature. He's a pretty humble, lowly creature. And yet, the ant has certain qualities. You'll notice that without any lord, without any oversight, without any compulsion, the ant automatically thinks ahead. The ant is far-sighted, and notice that is put in the language here that in verse 8, they provide or they secure their food in the summer and they gather their food in the harvest. In other words, there is a time coming, namely the winter time, when there's not going to be any food, not going to be any harvest. And so the old saying is, make hay while the sun shines. The ant is busy gathering and storing its food when the time is right for that, and in making up, laying up things for the winter when things are going to be meager. First of all, the ant, and secondly, the ant is industrious, busy, never ceases its activity. In the time that it has, it makes the most of it. And so poverty then is the opposite of being like the ant. Poverty comes from one's idleness, from one's sloth. I was asking Alfredo tonight the word for lazy in Spanish. What? Flobo? Flojo. Flojo. Never, didn't know that. That's lazy in Spanish. Well, sluggard is lazy in English. That's the idea. We get a sluggard, a sloth. And you know what a sloth is an animal that barely moves. And notice the picture here is a little sleep, a little nodding, a little folding of the hand. It's the idea, I just want to sleep a little longer. I don't want to get up. I want to lay here. I want to just stay here a little while longer. And we waste our time, we waste the opportunity, and we come to poverty because we're not industrious. We're not go-getters, or whatever you would say. And so the idea is to redeem the time, like the ant, redeem the time, do all that you can while you can. While you have opportunity, seize the opportunity. Now, I have a question for you. I think all of us understand the picture here, but doesn't this conflict with Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, take no thought for tomorrow, lay up not treasures on earth? Notice he didn't say don't lay up treasures. He just says make sure you lay them up in heaven. Okay? In other words, let's keep in mind, because where are you going to be? Where your treasure is, there's your heart also, and there is your destination. So let's don't lay up treasures where we're not going to be. But then the statement, take no thought or take no care for the things of tomorrow. Notice the context is that God's clothes the lilies of the field. He feeds the birds. Is he telling you not to be industrious? What's that? He feeds the ant, but the ant has to go get it. I think the whole point of what Jesus is saying on the Sermon on the Mount is let's don't fret. Don't be overly concerned. He's not saying you don't have to do that. I'm thinking back to the good old hippie days. I'm looking at Barry back here, 72 or so, when the Jesus People movement was going on. There you go, right there. There's the product. And no, Barry's a little different from most. He's very different from Barry, did you know anybody that in the Jesus People thing that just quit their job? I mean, I had them come out west, out where I was in Wyoming. They just going to let the Lord take care of them. Because after all, it says, take no thought for tomorrow. He feeds the birds, he'll feed me. And so they just quit their jobs and walked off. I'm just going to trust the Lord. You ran into a few of those, yeah. Yeah, the Lord also said, he that doesn't work doesn't eat. So, in other words, we have to sort of balance things. Is it wrong for us to plan ahead? In other words, that's what the ant's doing. The ant is thinking about the time coming when there's no food. And he is storing up, he's making plans. Is it wrong to plan? I think we can say no, because we find Paul himself making plans. He's sharing his plans with the church in Corinth and some of these other churches that I'm planning to come see you. I'm planning to come through there. He tells Philemon, get my room ready. I'm coming to see you. In other words, he is not forbidding the notion of planning. That's just good common sense and wisdom. That's what we're seeing here. But what he is saying, don't trust your plan. Don't think that you've got it all scoped out. Remember the man who built barns and barns and barns and bigger barns, and then thou fool, tonight thy soul is required of thee. So those all things fit together here. Okay, let's go to the next one. Now we have, starting in verse 12, a warning about hanging out. What is the scripture says? Bad company corrupts good conversation or good morals or good life's behavior. Who you hang with tends to rub off on you. And here we have this description, burial of this one, in verse 12. He says, the naughty person. Now, when you think of a naughty person, what do you think of? Kids, you're naughty. Jolly Saint Nick knows who's naughty and nice. We would say naughty is the opposite of nice. Is it really? Where is the word naughty coming from? What's the root? Naught. And what does naught mean? Nothing. And that is the meaning of naughty, certainly as it is here. In other words, we would have to say the word naughty has sort of lost some of its naughtiness or whatever over the years. It shifted its meaning. We use it as the opposite of nice. But the word in Hebrew here, Barry, is Belial. The Belial man. You ever hear of the son of Belial? What does Belial mean? Worthless. You oftentimes, when the biblical writer in the Old Testament wants to use the worst term he can about somebody, he calls them a son of Belial, the son of worthlessness. And that is exactly the term here, the worthless man. Notice the worthless man is also a wicked man, and he walks with a froward. There's a good old English word for you. Froward means twisted, warped, a froward mouth. He winks with his eyes. He speaks with his feet. He teaches with his fingers. Frowardness is in his heart. His very heart is twisted. He deviseth mischief continually. He soweth discord. Now, what jumps out here at me? I guess I better go through my slides here. There you go. Naughty is Belial, a man of Belial or a son of Belial. And I want you to notice the opposite. We've had a real contrast here. The sluggard is the guy who is completely inactive. The sloth barely moves. As opposed to the slothful man, we have this man, the Belial man, the worthless man, and notice the energy that is being expended. Now, what all these things mean, some of them think they're, verse 13, winking with the eyes and speaking with the feet and teaching with his finger. Some think that's seducing, seductive language. I don't know. What jumps out at me is that every part of his body is active, is engaged. So here we have a guy who is absolutely slothful, lazy as far as being engaged in anything productive. But when it comes to sin, we have this man who can't be still. Everything about him, all his agencies. In other words, we sometimes speak of the term total depravity. And by total depravity, we don't mean that a man is as bad as he can get. You can get a whole lot worse than you are. But what we mean is that depravity has invaded every aspect, every function of his life. And that's what you see described here. Everything from his eyes to his feet to his fingers down to his heart. His heart is crooked, and this crooked warpedness comes out of his life. And he's constantly looking around for mischief. It was interesting. I'm talking to Stephen Lees about the crook, the guy who's breaking into the houses, you know, and stealing your TV. He says these guys work as hard as somebody with a 40-hour-a-week job because they've got to scope it out. They've got to plan it. They've got to check it out. Then they have to actually do the robbery, and then they have to fence the stuff. And they've got to, he said, they work harder than some folks with a real job. In other words, the industry of the wicked man, his heart is like a sin factory that is running around the clock. He's constantly twitching because he's trying to find some other way to express his frowardness, his twistedness. Anybody know any folks like that? Yes, ma'am? Evil continually. And notice that language. He deviseth mischief continually. He is ceaseless in his action of investing in sin. So here you got this great contrast. One guy, you can't even get him out of bed. Lazy, slothful. And here's this other guy, the wicked man, who is as busy as a bee in devising wicked schemes and wicked plans. So what is the wisdom here? Verse 15. You can mark it that his day of calamity is coming, and it's going to come suddenly. He's never going to see it coming. And when it comes, it will be without remedy. Sooner or later, his mischief catches up with him. I was just thinking about the fact that drug dealers, gang members, people in the mafia don't live long. They don't have long lifespans. Why? Because sooner or later, they come up against somebody more wicked than they, and 9 times out of 10, they never see it coming. Next thing they know, they got their feet in concrete getting thrown off a bridge. Somebody is more wicked than they are. You want to run with that crowd. Do you understand then the wisdom that this is saying to a son? You want to run with this crowd? Consider their end. Considering where all this wickedness is going to take them. Eventually, justice catches up with them. You do reap what you sow. All right? Now, all parts are involved. Now we come to this very interesting section, and I've referred to this. This may be the only part of this particular chapter you've heard much about, because it's the one that we sometimes refer to. The things that God hates, seven things. And I point out, first of all, that hating is the necessary corollary of loving. Do you understand why that's so? If you love something, then you of necessity must hate the opposite. If you love being with someone, then you hate being absent from them. Correct? In other words, you must of necessity hate the opposite. We found that in 1 John, that there were three marks. You remember I used red, white, and blue? You love purity, you love truth, and you love the brethren, if you're a Christian. But you can also define those three things by their opposite. You not only love truth, you hate error. You not only love the brethren, you hate the world. Because if you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. And if you love righteousness, you must of necessity hate evil. You can't do both. You must hate. So to love something, and the more you love this particular thing, the more you will hate its opposite. And so you say, well, I just don't want a God that has hate in him. Well, you can't have a God. If he loves, he must of necessity hate the opposite of what he loves. So here is the idiom, this figure of speech, six, yea, seven. Now, that's a way of getting your attention. There's a lot of places that you'll find it three and four. We'll run into some of those. Seven is a little rarer. There is a reference. Let me see where it is. Over in the book of Job. Yeah, Job 5:19. Let me look at that since we're right here close. Job 5:19. He shall deliver thee in six troubles, yea, in seven, there shall no evil touch thee. See the six and seven? Similar to here. And so it is a figure of speech to sort of get your attention. The things about this list is the first one. The number one on the hit parade that God hates is what? It's that look on your face. It's that haughty, arrogant, proud look. And why would that be number one? Okay, it's proud. It's a proud look. But why would that be number one on the hit parade? Why didn't you say murder? Why wouldn't you say lying? Why pride? All right? It's the essence of all sin. All other sin springs from that one. It's the mother sin. It's the mother load. Your overblown opinion of me and mine, wanting to exalt myself, is what's behind everything else. It's why I murder somebody. It's why I steal from them. It's why I slander them. It's all coming from my sense of pride. So we look back at Satan. What was his sin? I will ascend. I will be like the Most High. In other words, I want to be up, 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 up. And so it is, and by the way, this is telling you, if this is the number one thing that God hates, then what's the number one thing that he loves and responds to? It's humility. Yeah, lowliness. So there you sort of see how these things go in tandem. But notice it's the primary one. And then I want you to notice again the range of sin here. In verse 17, it's the look, it's the tongue, it's the hands, it's the heart. Oh, by the way, did you see the heart here in verse 18? The heart that deviseth wicked imaginations. We would say the mind, wouldn't we? But again, the heart in the biblical way of thinking is not the emotions. That's your bowels in the biblical way of thinking. Okay, go figure. Your heart is the seat of your thought life. Okay, as a man thinks in his heart, so he is. You get the picture? And notice this goes along with that same idea. This is your imaginations in your heart. So notice we've had the look, the tongue, the hands, the heart, the feet. the mouth speaking lies and sowing discord among brethren. So we've got the whole man again. Here's total depravity shown to us once again. That there's no, how did Isaiah put it? No soundness in him from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet. All of his faculties are engaged. And it all springs from that proud look on your face. You ever hear somebody say, I just want to slap that look off you? Well, you've had that look slapped off, okay? Yeah. All right. The final section here is again, and it's the longest, and it's the one I'm going to hurry over the fastest because we've been here. Both chapter 5, the preceding chapter, and chapter 7, the following chapter, all deals with this warning about the prostitute or the adulteress. And here we find it again here in chapter 6. And of course, in advice to a young man, this is very important. Notice that, however, that this starts with this parental instruction in verse 20, that you're to keep your father's commandment, your mother's law, and you are to bind them about you, wrap yourself up in them, tie them around your neck. And all of that is fancy language of saying, don't let these things leave you. Don't let them depart from you. Keep them close by. I love the way this, let me back up. That's not back. There we go. Look at the verbs here. Verse 22. These things, your father and the instruction of your mother will lead you. When you sleep, it'll keep you. When you wake up, it shall talk with thee. What's that old country and western song? I hear voices all the time. You remember? That's exactly what this is talking about. That the teaching, the instruction of my parents haunts me. I hear these things constantly in my ears. And so notice the language. Verse 23, these things are a light to my feet, a lamp. The law of my father and my mother is like a light to my way. It shows me the ways of life, and especially it keeps me from the adulteress. And there's a warning here, is not to verse 25, to lust after her beauty, or to let her take thee with her eyelids. Gals, your eyes, you know, y'all been using those things for a long time, right? Winking or batting the eyes, you know. Isn't it amazing how much time you spend on your eyes? You ever thought about that? How much time? I better get off this before I get myself in trouble. But, I mean, just that one part of your body. And why? It works. That's exactly right. That's what he's saying. So in other words, watch out for her eyes. Watch out for her tongue. He uses a couple of things here as examples that basically to you, a man is brought to a piece of bread. In other words, we talk about men thinking of women as objects. But this works the other way as well. To the prostitute, the man is nothing but money. That's all she's after. I don't care what she says, all she's after is your money. You understand? It's just a big come on. It's a trick. It's a guise. And so to her, all you are is a piece of bread. Secondly, he goes and talks about the fact that it's absolutely impossible to embrace coals and not get burned. Or he uses the language of walking on hot coals. You've seen the natives do that. I'm not sure how that works, but I'm not going to try it because I believe he's right. You're going to walk on hot coals, you're going to get burned. The idea is, what do we say? Play with fire. You'll get burned. And you are doing exactly that when you're fooling around with a prostitute or, especially in this context, another man's wife. You are playing with fire. There's an a priori argument again going on here. We had one with the ant. Now we have one with the poor man who steals a piece of bread because he's hungry. Look at the example here in verse 30. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul when he's hungry. But if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. The point that is being made here is that if a man steals because he's starving to death to eat, it's still stealing, but we don't despise him. We understand. Do you understand? We're somewhat sympathetic. And yet, as he goes on to say, if he's found out, if he's caught, he still has to restore sevenfold, and even if that's going to ruin him, if that's going to, verse 31, he's going to have to give all the substance of his house. He's going to bring his household to nothing. In other words, the law is still the law, and he's still going to have to restore it. But at least we can understand, okay, the guy was starving to death. Now, does this mean it's okay to steal if you're starving to death? No. You remember, The proverb, we got a long way to go. Right at the end of Proverbs of Limer, the king, who says, keep two things from me. Don't ever give me too much, lest I deny the Lord, and don't ever give me too little, lest I steal. In other words, just feed me with what I need. Because you give me too little, I know myself too well, I'm apt to steal, and stealing is against the law. It doesn't matter if you're hungry. It's still against the law, but at least we can understand it. So you get the picture. Here's a man who's starving to death. He's stealing a piece of bread in order to survive. He's caught, and the law brings a severe penalty upon him, even though we can, in some sense, be sympathetic. Then he turns around and says, what about the adulterer? And as some commentators point out, it appears that he assumes that this person has a wife. In other words, he's not starving to death. I mean, do I have to be any more graphic than that? He's got some bread at home, okay? In other words, we're not dealing with utter necessity that he's going to die if he doesn't get some bread. You understand? This is not in the same category, and yet the man who indulges in this sin, number one, there is no sympathy for him. Notice how it's described in verse 33. What he's going to get? He's going to get a wound, he's going to get hurt, and he's going to get dishonor. He's going to be shamed, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. In other words, we can understand in the case of a thief who steals a piece of bread in order to survive that we have a sense of sympathy for him. We don't despise him. But the adulterer, that's another story. This was not a case of hardship. This is not a case of have to. This is not a case of necessity. And so there is no sympathy for the adulterer. And then the last thing here is that you're going to bring upon yourself utter destruction. You're not going to be able to buy your way out of this one. Remember, the thief that steals, the severe penalty, pay back sevenfold what you stole, is pretty steep, but it's at least a price that perhaps you can pay. In the case of adultery, what did the law require? Death. In other words, you're not going to buy your way out of it. Well, you'll say, well, surely I can pay off her husband. And the fellow is saying, no, not likely. He's not going to be in the negotiating mood. That's the way it says here in verse 34. Jealousy is the rage of a man. Therefore, he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom. Neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts. You can give him everything you want. He wants your neck. When you have sinned like this against him and against his wife. So in other words, notice the a fortiori argument. Bad enough for the thief to steal a piece of bread when he's starving. But oh, how much more severe is someone who gets caught in the web of adultery. And so there's the warning, son. You enjoy long life, stay away from these kinds of things. Stay away from these activities. Don't come near them. And therefore now, this is sandwiched between two other instructions on the same thing. Remember what follows is the man looking out the window and seeing the simple man turned down by the prostitute's house, headed to destruction. And so the warning is don't take the first step in that direction. Well, there we are. Certainly things worth considering. And one way we would say this is sanctified common sense. I'm not sure how common sense is these days, but it's just sort of sanctified logic that if God be true, if His word be true, if His law be true, if He is a judge and so forth, you say, well, wait a minute, He doesn't hate me, I'm His son. God hates these things no matter who commits them. He's not pleased. I heard a preacher say that David was just as pleasing to God when he was in the arms of Bathsheba as when he was dancing before the Ark of the Covenant. Do you believe that? I don't believe it. Because when you read the account of what David did, the last verse says, the thing which David did displeased the Lord. No, I don't care who it is, whether it's David that does this kind of thing, it's displeasing to God, and he reaps the consequences of it. So, and followed him, the sword never departed from his house. Followed him the rest of his life. So, a word to the wise. Learn from the mistakes of others. Don't repeat them yourself. Okay, we'll go on, move ahead a little bit here next time. But, do you see there's a lot of interesting logic, counsel, very helpful, very valuable, if we follow it. That's why the language, bind these things around your neck, tie them close by. Let us go to prayer tonight.